A defendant in the case of a murdered teacher may be mentally unfit for trial. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us about the increasing competitiveness of solar energy, and in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Brian Grewley about covering 9/11 and about the future of journalism. A defense expert says a Colorado man seeking to avoid trial in the murder of a Montana teacher is easily confused and has the mental capacity of an 11-year-old. Psychologist Greg Olley told the Sydney, Montana courtroom today that 24-year-old Michael Keith Spell is unfit for trial in the January 2012 killing of a local teacher, Sherry Arnold. Olley says Spell cannot comprehend the legal issues in the case. However, defense testimony also revealed that doctors at Montana State Hospital suspected Spell was pretending when he could not answer some questions during an evaluation. A co-defendant has pleaded guilty, and Spell could face the death sentence if convicted. The case has highlighted the steep social costs of a Northern Plains oil boom that drew the defendants into the region looking for work. And in other news from around the state, the National Park Service has decided against shooting wild bison with vaccine-laced bio-bullets to prevent the spread of an animal disease. NPS Regional Director Sue Massica signed a record of decision earlier this month that leaves in place the occasional syringe vaccination of bison calves and yearlings that are captured outside the northern boundary of the park. For more than a decade, wildlife officials have weighed shooting Yellowstone bison with absorbable vaccine-laced bullets to prevent the spread of the disease brucellosis to livestock. The concept was supported by cattle ranchers. About half of Yellowstone's 4,600 bison test positive for the disease, which causes pregnant animals to prematurely abort their young. Yellowstone's chief scientist, David Halleck, has said vaccinations would cost $300,000 annually, but do little to drive down infection rates. Missoula officials say there's precious little available space left at the city police department and critically important and very expensive fire department gear, such as engines and ladder trucks, are nearing the end of their reasonable life expectancy. The Missoula City Council tonight holds a public hearing on a proposal that supporters say would remedy both problems, and it's called a public safety and justice district, which would generate millions of additional dollars. City Chief Administrative Officer Bruce Bender says the proposed citywide district would provide some flexibility when making these important budget-making decisions.
Especially, it's problematic for the fire department that they have to come out for these big replacements at one time. Historically, we'd replace a ladder and three or four fire engines, and so at one time you got to do all that. So it lacks the ability for them to be flexible, like, well, do we need to replace it this year? Could we wait another year and all that? So the taxing district would allow us to basically put a bond on the taxes, but it gives them the flexibility to decide when to do it. And then also with the police facility, this would allow us to bond that particular facility too, and the public safety tax district would enable us to do that.
Critics don't necessarily deny the need for the revenue, but say there are better ways to appropriate it, through the general fund, by setting priorities, and making hard-nosed budgeting decisions.
Basically, we're capped by the state on how much we can levy on our general fund taxes, and we're capped at a very burdensome one-half the rate of inflation. So we can't even meet our operational needs with that type of constraint. You know, the typical cost increases in salaries and the cost increases in operation equipment and whatever that we all experience normally. The general fund can't even keep up with that. And what we've tried to do to deal with our operational issues is to look at more fees and to look at other methods to fund that. But that has a certain limitation, too.
If approved, Bender says the proposed district's assessment would start out a bit smaller in comparison.
Admittedly, these big projects, even the trucks and stuff, take a year to pull together. We'd start working on it next year. So the first year's level assessment would be fairly small in comparison. For an average house of $250,000 value, it would be $11 the first year. And then the second year is our expectation that we will start making these payments on the equipment and also on the police facility expansion. So then it would go up to $24 in the second year.
Bender says that under state law, this evening's hearing essentially kicks off the public notification process. Property owners then have 60 days to protest creation of the district. A public vote on the matter would be required if at least 10% of eligible property owners file protests. Also on the agenda at tonight's City Council meeting, Mayor John Ingen is scheduled to proclaim April as Sexual Assault Awareness Month in Missoula. YWCA of Missoula spokeswoman Amanda Opitz says the idea is to draw even more awareness to what most know is a very real problem. While plenty of work remains to be done, Opitz says she thinks Missoulians have made tremendous progress in the issue of sexual assault over the past few years.
Speaking from the standpoint of a service provider, there's some incredible work being done to address this issue in our community, whether that be on the campus level, you know, with Missoula PD, and we're really starting to look at how we can collaborate so that we can really create systems that are survivor-friendly, that are easy to understand, that we're not duplicating efforts throughout our different organizations. And that, to me, is really exciting. It's very encouraging. And we're just really excited to be a part of that movement and a part of making some really positive steps in our community to address this issue.
YWCA Missoula is part of an interagency group called Make Your Move Missoula, which is launching a new training series for local bartenders. Opitz says the goal would be to train bartenders to recognize and interrupt predatory behavior.
Some of that can look like people purchasing drinks for someone who may or may not want that. We hear other things like using date rape drugs, you know, Rufinol, things like that, to spike a drink to make a victim more susceptible or more vulnerable. So what we really want to do is we want the folks that are serving to be able to recognize some of those behaviors, you know, people trying to sequester someone who may be inebriated away from their friends or things like that, and give them some tools so that they can step in and make sure that that person feels safe and that they have options.
The first SAFE, or Sexual Assault-Free Establishment, trainings will be held on April 14th with staff from Missoula's Rhino Bar. UM students will also perform outreach in the bars later that week to help educate bar patrons on the issue. Bars who agree to host this training receive a decal that will hang in the window notifying patrons that the staff has been educated in this curriculum and that people can reach out to them if they need help. Additionally, there will be signage posted throughout the bar and in bathrooms listing local resources and crisis numbers. The price of solar panels continues to drop, making them a more reasonable option for households. Montanans are taking notice, with solar adoption rates rising in the last 5 years. Capital reporter Dan Boyce visits a Helena low-income housing complex to be the site of a brand new solar project that's one of the state's largest.
88-year-old Spencer Munyon had problems with his eyesight last year. He had to move from his home in Anaconda to Helena so his niece could take care of him. He moved into the new River Rock Residences.
It's for people that don't make too much money.
The nonprofit Rocky Mountain Development Corporation finished constructing the residences last year, low-income senior living. The budget had a little extra wiggle room, so RMDC put solar panels on all 10 buildings, almost 340 panels. They went online in January.
The bill, light bill went down anyway, it seemed like.
His nurse confirms yes, his power bill has dropped since the solar panels were turned on. And that was the point.
But we're generating out of this array, which is a...
Jackson Isbell owns and operates Solar Montana. He installed the solar panels here. And right now the panels are generating about a fifth of their potential power.
They're doing pretty good. I mean, considering that it's completely overcast and we do have some snow in the air.
He says he expects the panels to pay for about half of the annual electricity costs for the seniors living in these apartments because of net metering. It's something Montana's had in place since 1999.
So say you're producing more power in the day than you're using, that power's going to get pushed out to the grid, and in effect, it's going to credit your bill.
State law says Montana utilities have to take power from small power producers like rooftop solar panels, and they have to deduct the cost of that power from what that ratepayer owes. Kyla Mackey with the Montana Environmental Law Center says net metering has contributed to an expansion of solar all over the country, and the utilities which have to buy that power are not all thrilled, sponsoring legislation to cut net metering in many states.
You're seeing utilities push back against that growth, against the ability of customers to be able to install their own power.
We certainly understand people's desire to save money on their energy bills, and we support those efforts.
Butch Larcombe is a spokesman for Montana's largest electric utility, Northwestern Energy. He says net metering does bring up some issues. What rate should Northwestern pay for people's rooftop solar power? He says there are concerns. The power purchased from those panels shifts the cost burden to everyone else.
Just because some people put up solar panels on their house doesn't affect people down the street and their utility costs.
Solar advocates argue costs still go down for the average rate payer as more solar may avoid the need for utilities to build new expensive power plants in the future. As for next year's legislative session, Larcombe says it's too early to know what Northwestern's plans will be as far as bills about net metering. Back at the River Rock residences, Solar Montana owner Jackson Isbell says he's hoping for his busiest year yet. He says the price of solar panels has gone down 60% in the last few years. Panels with a 20-year lifespan are now paying for themselves in under a decade. A federal tax credit cuts 30% of the cost of solar panels right off the top. That lasts until 2016.
This is not a luxury item. This is something that every Montana homeowner can afford. When you look at terms of return on investment and everything else, this is a pretty safe bet.
As long as the market for solar continues looking like it does now. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
Brian Grewley is an award-winning mystery writer and a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, and he's delivering the annual Jeff Cole Memorial Lecture at the University of Montana this evening. Grewley is now a feature reporter for Bloomberg News after working many years for the Wall Street Journal. He was part of a team of journal reporters who won the Pulitzer Prize for their coverage of the 9/11 attacks. In this feature interview, Grewley talks with news director Sally Mock about the enormous changes in the journalism profession and about the challenges of covering 9/11.
I mean, I was proud of what we did at the Journal. I was proud of all, you know, my colleagues at competing papers and broadcast stations, because the coverage was, I thought, even-handed and detailed and in-depth, so that you can understand what really happened. In retrospect, those, you know, 2001 through 2003, say, when the Iraq War started, is really maybe the last great gasp for daily newspapers in America. I mean, they did a great job, but by then, the business model that newspapers relied on for so long had really begun to break down. And now, of course, it's broken beyond repair. So, which doesn't mean bad things for journalism. I guess it could, but to me, as long as there's demand for a product, in this case, things I didn't know 5 seconds ago, or great stories that move me or make me laugh or make me think, make me act, that demand is greater than it's ever been. And as long as there's demand, some smart kid is going to figure out how to meet that demand and renew the model, but it's going to be different.
Before we talk more about that, and I do want to talk about that, I think the other thing about the coverage after 9/11, I don't think people really thought as much as they should have of how challenging that was for the journalists who covered that, because many of them, including yourself, I'm sure, this was your hometown that had been attacked. I mean, it was a very personal story.
It was, and now for me in particular, I was actually in Washington, and it was attacked too, but not to the level that New York was. But my colleagues at the Journal in New York at the time worked in the financial center there, and they were kitty-corner from the towers. And for months, you could literally look down from the Journal newsroom on the 8th floor right into Ground Zero. And I think of these people whenever I hear pundits lacerating the media, either from the left or the right, because they got out of subways, they got out of cabs, they got off of ferries, and they got their notebooks out, And they started reporting the story and did an amazing job. In retrospect, I'm sure they didn't think of this at the time. They risked their lives. One of my colleagues got on his bike and rode back into Ground Zero after the buildings had fallen to do some reporting. And I saw all of the emails, the files that were coming from New York that afternoon. It was just a wave, a huge wave of files, 30,000 words worth, mostly from New York, some from Washington and Pennsylvania. And it was an amazing experience. Terrible experience, but, you know, this is what you prepare for. This is why you're a journalist.
My memory is of all the broadcast journalists, many of whom were standing there covered in the dust and debris from the tower collapse.
It was not good for them. That was a very dangerous place to be.
But there they were, still calmly doing their job on air. It's incredible.
Yes.
Incredible. That's why news will survive, is because these events continue to happen. News continues to happen, and people want the story, of
course. They sure do. I can only speak for the journal because I was there. So I assembled 3,000 of those 30,000 words into a story that ran on page one the next day. Well, today, if, God forbid, a 9/11 happened, all of those memos would have been cleaned up and put online one by one, one after another. We probably would have weaved them together into various lengths of stories. But we wouldn't be waiting, you know, 24 hours to tell people what was going on. And by the time, like by 7 o'clock that night, when my story was just going to the printer, all of that stuff would already be digested.
Is that good?
It is. I don't know if it's good or bad. It's the way it is. And if you don't adapt to the way it is, you will be left behind.
So the upside, of course, of many of these changes is that the information dissemination is enormous compared to what it used to be, and the audience is enormous compared to what it used to be. It's worldwide instead of local.
And it's also participatory. They don't just consume it and then write a letter to the editor, a weak letter. They consume it, and if they don't like it or they have something to add or anything, it's bam. You hear from them right away on Twitter or Facebook or email or whatever.
The barrier between journalist and audience is gone.
For the most part, yes.
So what's the downside of all this?
Well, one obvious one, and we saw it with the Newtown massacre, with the Boston Marathon bombings, and again with this Malaysian thing, is the rush to be first results in some pretty dubious pieces of news. And
a lot of crap.
Yeah, a lot of crap. And that's a good word for it. And, you know, you don't want your motto to be always first, frequently right. You want to be right. And I think you want to be right not just because it's the right thing to do, which it is, but also, you know, it's in your own self-interest, because smart people who look to news organizations of any site or websites, whatever they are, for information, want reliable information, especially if they're relying on it to make investment decisions or decide which college their kid wants to go to or kid should go to or buy a house. They don't want to be relying on people who get it wrong half the time because it'll influence them.
Or if you're a family member of someone who's in that plane crash.
Right.
You mentioned the demise of newspapers. Is that true for every newspaper, do you think, or just the big name newspapers in terms of the short future they may have?
Well, the big ones, particularly the Journal and the New York Times, have had some success in getting people to pay for subscriptions.
The Journal was actually took the lead on that.
Right.
I mean, started right
this out. This is like in the late 90s. We were already doing that.
Right.
Not as aggressively in retrospect as we probably should have, but
more
it
so
is
than
making
most.
It is getting some revenue from that part of the stream, and the Times is too. But you know, those are very big brands, and whether say the paper here, the Missoulian, can do that. I don't know if they are trying to do it, but I think that would be more challenging because people can gravitate to all these other sources. You just go on Twitter and find out what happened. Now, you're not going to find out a lot on Twitter about what happened in Missoula and Butte and Bozeman and Helena, which may be, you know, again, kids, youngsters who see there's a need for that, figuring out ways to get those people what they want.
I know some journalists, and I'm sure you do too, Mr. Grulli, who have left the profession because they're unhappy with the changes and also feel like that too much is being asked of the reporter now, that the time they used to spend doing research for their stories and so on is now challenged because they have to be doing more online work and more right. video, more audio, more everything in the same amount of time. And they didn't like that, so they left.
Right. Well, I should say, and I'm a reporter. I've been an editor and a reporter, and I'm a reporter now, that since time immemorial, reporters have said they have too much to do and not enough time to do X, Y, and Z. Okay, so let's get that out of the way. But it is true that reporters today are being asked to do a lot of different things. And it's, again, it's up to these organizations, the editors, to figure out how to maximize the output. I think that's a more difficult question for the New York Times and Wall Street Journals of the world, just because they have a legacy. And there are certain things they did before, and people don't want to let go of those things. And some of them shouldn't be let go of, investigative stuff in particular. It'll be easier. Easy is probably not the right word, but simpler for smaller, more narrowly focused news organizations. Like some of the new websites that have come up that focus on environmental news or education news or politics, well, Politico and Ezra Klein's new thing, Vox. And I think more and more you're going to see this rather than having big grab bag news organizations that do everything, that they'll focus on one thing that they get really good at and really deep, and readers will gravitate to that and they'll be willing to pay because it's got value.
You said earlier, and I think I just want to reiterate this, something you said in an earlier interview as well, that, quote, the reporter's mission is as ever, tell people things they didn't know 5 seconds ago and tell them stories that make them think, laugh, debate, cry, and act. That's still our job.
It's still our job, and it's not only that, it's just what we do as human beings. I mean, telling stories to each other is as much a part of our lives as eating and sleeping. It's what we do all the time. You know, most of the stories we tell each other aren't newsworthy, so to speak. But people want to understand their world, and it's our job to try to help them as best we can by telling them things they didn't know, by taking them places they can't go or they wouldn't want to go, and telling them what's going on.
Well, I've been speaking with someone who's been telling us what's going on for many years and won a Pulitzer Prize for that, and that's Brian Grulli, who's a reporter for Bloomberg News. Mr. Grulli, such a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide, tonight should be partly cloudy with lows 17 to 24 degrees. Tomorrow, expect partly cloudy skies with highs in the upper 40s to mid-50s. Central Montana tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of snow showers in the evening and lows 10 to 15 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy, becoming partly cloudy with highs 35 to 45 degrees. For southwest Montana tonight, expect partly cloudy skies and lows 20 to 25 degrees. Tomorrow should be partly cloudy with highs 45 to 55 degrees. And again, journalist Brian Grulli will give the annual Cole Lecture tonight at 7 o'clock in the University Center Theater on the University of Montana campus. His talk is titled Confessions of a Dinosaur, All That Matters is the Story, and it is free and open to the public. And now for the editorial comments of Tom Power.
In the late 1990s, as the Montana Power Company exited the electric utility industry and headed for bankruptcy as a telecommunication company, Montana Power sold off all of its Montana electric generating facilities to Pennsylvania Power and Light. The utility that bought Montana Power's electric and natural gas delivery system of pipes and wires, Northwestern Energy, is now trying to buy back those Montana hydroelectric facilities. Repatriating those hydroelectric facilities so that they serve Montana residents and are regulated by the Montana Public Service Commission might seem like a no-brainer. Why wouldn't we want to do that? However, as the Montana Public Service Commission has begun digging into the details of that proposed repurchase of these Montana hydroelectric facilities, some interesting information has surfaced about what Pennsylvania Power and Light, or PPL, wanted to sell. It turns out that PPL wanted to sell all of its interests in Montana's electric generating facilities, not just the hydroelectric dams, but also PPL's interest in the Colstrip and Courette coal-fired power plants. Northwestern's evaluation of that whole set of Montana electric generators led to the conclusion that the coal-fired electric generators had a negative value, while the hydroelectric facilities had a highly positive one. As a result, Northwestern Energy only offered to buy the hydroelectric facilities. Now some folks are suggesting that Northwestern was imprudent in not buying the coal-fired electric generators at bargain basement prices, rather than going after the more costly hydroelectric facilities. Besides imprudently passing up a bargain, some are suggesting that Northwestern was also disloyal to Montana's coal industry and complicit with environmentalists in undermining the future of Montana coal mining. As one of the Montana Public Service Commissioners has repeatedly pointed out, Montana has a larger coal reserves than any other state. Yet most of those Montana coal resources have yet to be developed. If Northwestern was imprudent or irrationally biased against coal, it is not alone in the utility world or the American investment community. PPL itself, before putting its Montana generating assets up for sale, announced that it was planning to shut down the Courette coal-fired power plant in Billings. Years earlier, electric utilities in Oregon and Washington agreed to stop burning coal in their largest electric generators, the Boardman and Centralia electric generating stations. The U.S. Department of Energy's Energy Information Administration recently reported that between 2010 and 2012, almost 13,000 megawatts of coal-fired generation had been retired. That is the equivalent of 17 Colstrip 3 plants. The Department of Energy also projected that 60,000 megawatts of coal-fired electric generators, the equivalent of over 80 power plants the size of Colstrip 3 or 4, would be retired between 2010 and 2040. Most of those power plants would be retired by 2016. This rush to abandon so many coal-fired generators is tied to two sets of economic factors. First, cheap natural gas has allowed gas-fired generators to displace what became more expensive coal-fired generators. As a result, the older, less efficient coal-fired generators have been used less and less often. Second, in 2015, these older coal-fired plants will be subject to EPA's mercury and air toxic standards. That will require significant reductions in emissions of mercury, acid gases, and toxic metals. Achieving those reductions in toxic emissions would require these older coal-fired generators to install scrubbers or other technology to eliminate the toxic material they now dump into the air. Making substantial additional investments in cleaning up these older, dirtier, and less efficient plants that are already only used part of the time often just does not make economic sense. Electric utilities are also planning to build almost no new coal-fired generators because of their economic cost and the risk of environmental regulation. As a result, while coal was responsible for 53% of electric generation in 2000, coal's share of generation had fallen to 37% by 2011. Coal's share is projected to settle at less than a third by 2040, while natural gas's share of electric generation is expected to more than double to 35%, higher than coal's share. Almost 93% of new electric generation will not be coal-fired over the next several decades. An additional problem is that removing these toxic materials from the air we breathe does not make those toxic materials disappear. After being removed from the exhaust of the power plants, they are typically deposited as sludge in open ponds, along with other waste products from burning coal. It is these coal wastes that back in 2008 broke free from TVA's dam at its Kingston coal-fired generator in Tennessee, releasing over a billion gallons of sludge, inundating homes and pouring into the tributaries of the Tennessee River. In early February of this year, a similar massive release of coal combustion products by Duke Energy into the Dan River polluted the water supply of Danville, Virginia. The Colstrip power plants have similar problems with their coal combustion sludge ponds that have been leaking into the ground for some time. State regulators and the EPA have only begun to investigate and try to control this source of water pollution from coal-fired electric generators. Control of that water pollution and remediation of existing groundwater pollution will also be costly to electric utilities with coal-fired generators. In that setting, it is not surprising that electric utilities are retiring existing coal-fired plants and investors are not interested in building new ones. But this is not because electric utilities are being imprudent or because Wall Street investors have become rabid environmentalists. Quite the contrary. In a clear-headed and hard-nosed way, these business people have evaluated the costs and risks associated with burning coal and made a rational business decision. To modify a famous political slogan, it's the economics, stupid.
Tom Power is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.